Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Slate's Political Gabfest is sponsored by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk using your own computer and printer. Right now, get a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer by going to Stamps.com and using the promo code GABFEST. And by Harry's, the shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. Visit Harrys.com for $5 off your first purchase with the promo code POLITICAL.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for March 20th, 2015, the Welcome Back Vladimir edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura in Washington, D.C. Packed house again this week. John Dickerson of Slate and CBS News is here. Hello, John.
Hi.
Wow. That was,
I don't know where that came from.
That was John Dickerson at 11. Before you went through the change.
Castrato Dickerson.
I don't talk much, you know, during the day. So this is my first chance to talk.
Your first words.
I was reading all day.
And Emily Bazelon is still on vacation. What a vacation. Can't wait for the stories when she gets back. So we have, making her first start for the GabFest, frequent guest. You've come in, injury time substitute. Occasionally made brilliant appearances, scored a couple of goals for us. Julia Yaffe of the New York Times Magazine. Is that where you are now?
Yes.
You may remember Julia from, I'm not sure what you remember her. What were you from her stints doing her Russian accent, which she will definitely bring out today.
Yeah, various Ukraine invasions.
Yes. Ukraine invasion one.
Yeah.
Ukraine invasion two.
Live show at Six and I. She joined us on stage.
Yes, there was some Ukraine then. Question, John.
Yeah.
Do you think that Julia is Wally Pipping Emily? Like that Emily Bazelon is just Julia's today. Julia comes in and just takes that role away from Emily, or not? I think it's unlikely.
I fear her wrath.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. But what was the name of the movie? Is that the
Pride of the Yankees?
No, I'm thinking of the movie where the understudy. Female understudy takes.
All About Eve.
All About Eve.
Oh, are you All About Eve? Do you know that movie?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, my God.
The freaky movie.
That's a great movie. Whoa.
It's like Gaslight. Like those. I have those two movies in my
They're
head.
Very together. Anyway, you were not Wally Pipping Emily Bazelon. Emily will be back next week. No worries, listeners. On this week's GabFest, Bibi Netanyahu sails to victory in the Israeli elections, but not before torpedoing peace talks and making disgusting racist remarks about Israel's Arab citizens. What is the future of the U.S.-Israeli relationship? Then Julia is here, which means that we have to talk about Vladimir Putin, thank God, who reemerged, a rabbit from a hat this week. Where did he go? Julia, if you know, save it for when we get to the actual segment.
He's like Punxsutawney Phil. He shows up, and if he sees his shadow, then it's...
He shadow, because he's like a demon.
Right, then it's 6 months more of oppression and murdering your opponents.
six years more.
There's no reflection of him in any mirrors.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that true? Has that been tested?
They say.
Then, I can't wait to talk about Putin with you. It's going to be so much fun. Then Aaron Schock, the young Republican congressman, resigns after he's caught fiddling his expenses. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. Dickerson preparing a great one. I see him preparing it even as we speak. And in Slate Plus, we will have your questions, listeners. You sent us some questions on Facebook about things that you wanted us to talk about in Slate Plus, we will talk about them. Don't forget, we have a live show at the Bell House in Brooklyn in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 3 weeks, April 8th. It's sold out, so I don't know why I'm announcing it, just to torture people who couldn't get tickets. But those of you who are coming, we'll see you April 8th at the Bell House. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has been in the news more than any American leader has been, it seems like, after a brutal campaign to retain his office that included an incendiary speech to the U.S. Congress about Iran's nuclear program, a public affirmation there would never be a Palestinian state on his watch, and a racist eruption against Israeli Arabs voting. He won a surprisingly easy re-election on Tuesday. He captured 30 seats in the 120-seat Knesset, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it turns out that along with other right-wing parties and religious parties and a center-right party or two, he will easily be able to forge a majority coalition. His victory confounded the Israeli left, which thought it had a great chance to win an election for the first time in a very long time. Julia, how are the U.S. and Europe, which are traditionally the very strongest allies of Israel, going to deal with a resplendent Netanyahu who now has, you know, a real strong victory, but has said these absolutely terrible things that go against the policies that their governments are pursuing?
Now, it's going to be really awkward, right? It's like, I don't know, the example I keep thinking of is, you know, your friend has a girlfriend that you don't like. You tell your friend you don't like the girlfriend, and then they get back together, and then you have to deal with them, and it's very awkward at parties. I mean, after...
That's good. I like that.
It was among my father's best advice, never trash your friend's exes, just in case. You know, after that speech in Congress, after the fact that Bibi himself, on the eve of the election, said that nefarious foreign funders were pouring money into the campaigns of his rivals. You know, he's poisoned the well so much himself. Leaders in the West, including Obama and Susan Rice and other people in the administration, have been so overtly waiting for him to lose his seat that I don't know how they're going to talk when it comes time to it.
John, how are they going to talk?
I don't know. I mean, well,
why?
And there's
if
a lot
Emily
of reporting.
Were here, she would know. You guys don't even know.
No, I know. Well, that's why we find ourselves in the whistling chasm of ignorance without her here. But there seem to be two things coming out here. One is people fumbling around for some kind of way that they could get back to yes. Netanyahu doing something to reach out, which he already seems to be doing, by the way. He, on Thursday morning, he said, oh, that stuff about not believing in a two-state solution, that's not right. My position hasn't changed, which is silly, because nobody believed he ever cared about a two-state solution anyway, since he said that he did in 2009. So nobody believed him. And then when he canned it to get reelected, everybody thought, well, of course, he's just saying out loud what he's always, the way he's always behaved. So he's not going to undo this. And also, part of the two-state solution is that the United States has said, to reach a two-state solution, we have to work through and with Israel. And now it's sort of, it's the U.S. can't maintain that position with a straight face.
Right. But so how the United States has had such a historically strong connection to Israel for any number of reasons, which we will not bother to go into, but it's a very, very deep historic relationship. How can we maintain this a relationship with Israel that is as strong as it's been, given what the government of Israel is?
Well, this is one of the ironies of the Bibi victory, is that for somebody who mongered so much fear in the run-up to this election and made it all about security and showing Israel to be isolated in a sea of hate, to jeopardize the one international relationship that really is a guarantor of Israeli security seems kind of to run counter to that message of security first, second, and third, right? The other thing to what John was saying is that one possibility for, you know, what we could see happening in the next year or so is Obama and Bibi trying to wait each other out. Either Obama trying to wait for Bibi's government to collapse, that, you know, maybe his coalition will be shakier than he wants it to be, or Bibi waiting out a lame duck Obama and hoping a Republican wins in 2016.
And the other question is whether the United States either stands down from, well, doesn't block some of the efforts in the UN to go after Israel on the question of settlements, which, and also I can't remember if
or
this
Palestinian
was,
statehood.
Or Palestinian statehood, exactly. And the I can't remember whether it was in your litany, but in advance of the election in the last week, Netanyahu basically came out and and said what everybody believed, that he was fine. Not only was he fine with the settlements, but the settlements were like a useful and good thing. Another thing that he wasn't supposed to say out loud. So does the U.S. allow those measures in the U.N., which it had been blocking or not signing on to, does it allow them to go forward as a way of punishing him? And as Will Salatin wrote, then it's a question of, are you punishing Israel or are you punishing Netanyahu? And there may be no distinction between the two.
One thing that is sort of a step back question about this is there's a premise in the United States, there's this premise like that we kind of have 50-50 politics, that it's because we have a two-party system, the parties essentially will position themselves to get 50.1% of the vote. We have not had a case where parties go so far off the rails that they're unable to compete, not since the Civil War, and nor have we had a situation where a party has become a kind of dominant majority over more than, you know, 20 years or so. In Israel, what seems to be happening for demographic reasons is that the left, which had essentially ruled the country for the first 50 years of its existence, is headed for permanent minority status and cannot compete. And therefore, the kind of fundamental principles of democratic principles around which Israel has been built, including like minority rights for Arab citizens and not oppressing the Palestinians too much, are gone. And so I wonder if Israel has always been the great democratic state of that area. It's been had a vibrant democracy. It still has a vibrant democracy, but now it is a vibrant democracy where there are 2 million people who are living in occupied territories who don't get to vote. But can this be a country which we can even consider a democracy if it continues down the path it's going on? I don't know. I'm worried.
I mean, it can just be, I am too, but it can just be a right-leaning democracy. And, you know, here I would like to...
But a right-leaning democracy where you have, because you occupy millions of people, it's not a democracy. That's
been around since 1967. So you could argue that since 1967, it hasn't really been a democracy, right? Where it rules millions of people who don't have representation and don't have the vote.
Right. Although, but that was held out by Israel as a temporary state. But if Netanyahu is saying, this is not a temporary state, this is a permanent state, we are going to be the occupier of this land, we are going to be the rulers of these people, then... Doesn't that make a difference?
Does it really matter, though, what is being said? Because like John said, everybody knew that neither Netanyahu nor Naftali Bennett nor anybody on the right really believed in a two-state solution. And it seems like fewer and fewer people in the middle and the middle left or the center left are starting to believe in a two-state solution. It seems like the two-state solution is this relic of the 90s that people still keep talking about as if they're waiting for the Messiah. And really what, you know, the path we're heading down is a one-state solution where Jews are the minority.
Here's where I wonder if the U.S. is kind of stuck, though, is that when you asked your original question, which is how are they going to rebuild the relationship? Well, the way they would rebuild the relationship is if there's belligerence towards Israel by Iran or any other country, that the U.S. will still come to Israel's security aid. And even if it doesn't mean actually engaging in a hot war, it will do symbolic things to prove that relationship is still strong if there's ever a threat. So that is still intact. So that would be one way. The second way would be...
I have a point to make about that.
Okay, go ahead. Second point is, if the U.S., one of the things that I read is, since Netanyahu doesn't care about a two-state solution, he's not going to work towards it, just let the Palestinian question deteriorate so much that it becomes his problem. I don't think that works because everybody thinks everybody in the Middle East, the U.S. is so closely associated with Israel. Bad behavior on Israel's part, which is to say letting the Palestinian situation just totally deteriorate, would be seen as U.S. The U.S. would be seen as complicit in that. And therefore, the United States would be penalized. So in other words, you can't let it just fall apart because the U.S. ends up getting hurt by it. In the end, it's not just Netanyahu who gets hurt by that.
First of all, I'm not sure how much worse the Palestinian situation could get.
Right.
I'm not sure. I don't think Gaza could get worse, worse than it already is. That's number one. Number two is, on your first point, John, like this is your point, like, if Israel's security is threatened, the United States will rise to defend her. And of course we would. There's a kind of living in the past element of that. Israel's security is not threatened. It is surrounded by neighbors. There's disorder in its neighborhood. But there's no country which can or has any interest in attacking Israel militarily. You know,
you have rockets being fired into southern Israel or, you know, the periodic attack from the north by Hezbollah. So it's this latent threat that's always there. I think that's what's
But the Hezbollah about. Cannot conquer Israel. God, you know, the Palestinians of Gaza cannot conquer. Israel's security existentially is not under threat. I mean, you could argue that Iran maybe represents
equating security with existence. Like, its existence may not be threatened, but could a neighbor or a terrorist group deliver a blow that takes away, I don't know, a few hundred Israelis, a few thousand Israelis? Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, the US but so what? I mean, it happens in every country in the world, practically. Every country in the world faces that risk.
And Israel is very well equipped, much better equipped
to defend it. What security can the U.S. offer?
But it's not in the U.S. interest for Israel.
This is not 1967. It's not 1973. There's no armies massed on Israel's borders that threaten Israel. It's not the case.
Well, but what the U.S. doesn't want is missiles coming into Israel, Israel retaliating, other Arab states joining in the fight and having like a conflagration in the Middle of the, in the Middle East. That's what they don't. That's what the U.S. doesn't want. It wants more stability in the Middle East, not less. And a weakened Israel or an Israel that terrorist countries think is weakened because its relationship with the United States is in question. They start doing all kinds of things that destabilize the situation.
What kinds of things? There's Hezbollah in the north, which is like a nuisance, and there's the various Palestinian terrorist groups, and then
well, they start killing Israelis by blowing stuff up.
Yeah, and we don't want that. Israel has a great capacity to defend itself.
But the problem is when Israel defends itself, then Iran says, we don't like that Israel is being aggressive, and so we're going to keep building.
Iran.
And it's not just Iran, of course. Yeah, it's the rest of, it's all of its neighboring countries say we don't like an aggressive Israel, and particularly their street doesn't want an aggressive Israel.
I think this is like a canard. I don't think Israel is the obsession in Arab capitals or in Middle Eastern capitals generally that it once was.
It might be on the street. I don't know. I'm not an expert in this. I'm no scientist, but. The one thing I want to say is the security obsession, I think you're right. It does cloud a lot of thinking in Israel, and it warps the politics, and it also puts Israel geopolitically in an unfortunate situation vis-a-vis its, you know, founding ideals of democracy. Think about what happened in the Arab Spring or what happened with the uprising in Syria. Israel ended up being on the side of Mubarak and Assad precisely because it wants stability and security, and yeah, I mean, that's a really
troubling conundrum. To the extent that Netanyahu thinks that the United States doesn't have his back and starts going to try to stop an Iranian nuclear deal militarily, not good.
So actually, let's close with two quick questions. One, does this election make an Iranian deal more or less likely?
I am of the opinion that there won't be a deal, that they'll just keep talking and setting up future meetings to plan future meetings, and that nothing will ever get signed. And sometimes that in and of itself is a diplomatic victory, that you're just still at the table talking, even if you don't ever secure a tangible deal. That's also a diplomatic victory after, you know, given what U.S.-Iranian relations have been through.
Right. They're going to delay breakout capacity by just meeting and meeting and meeting and meeting and meeting until they're just, it's like 17 years later.
It's its own form of hell.
Oh my God!
Can you imagine the news stories we have to read though in the next few years if they're just still meeting in Geneva like once a month and never reaching any deal? It's just you can just use
Do
the same
them?
Copy. No, never.
This is like there was always that moment in the 90s where they would talk about final status talks about the Middle East. You're always like, there are final status talks, and you think like, not really.
God,
it doesn't
90s.
Seem like that.
Final status, end of history.
Right.
It doesn't seem like they're finalizing anything. Final quick question. So the most shocking thing about this election, I think, to many people was the comment that Netanyahu made the day of the election, the day before election, about how Israeli Arab voters, citizens of Israel, were voting in droves and that endangered
God forbid.
Governance.
Yeah,
God
20% of the country is Arab.
Yes. So, like, is there, I mean,
and
is that
so
okay?
So
people
messed up that he said that because people on the pro-Israel right constantly trot out this figure to show how amazing and democratic Israel is when they say that Arabs living inside Israel have more political rights than Arabs living in other Arab countries. And then when they actually start to vote, it's like, what? What are you doing? Go home.
Peter Beinart said he had a conversation with somebody at the White House who said this is the thing that riled the president the most. Because if you think of So this person was arguing, if you think of the president's view on race as being, you know, kind of a core part of who he is, and having just come out of the Selma anniversary, to see somebody do this about voting on, you know, in the walk up to an election, I mean, it would be like, it's like a George Wallace. It's not, it's worse than that, because it's somebody who's actually in position to get actually elected to be the leader of the country or whatever.
Settlements now, settlements tomorrow, settlements forever.
Yeah, very nice. Southern Israeli accent. The GabFest is sponsored this week by Stamps.com. Getting your mailing and shipping done can seem like a no-win situation. Going to the post office takes up valuable time. But leasing a postage meter is expensive with multi-year commitments and hidden fees. Luckily, there is a better way, which is Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer. And you can get special postage discounts you can't find at the post office. Plus, Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. You can save up to 80% compared to a postage meter, and you'll avoid those time-consuming trips to the post office. Right now, use our promo code GABFEST for a special offer, no-risk trial, and a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. For all the details of the special offer and to sign up today, go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's Stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. Vladimir Putin reappeared this week after a 10-day absence. Rumors. He was sick. He was having plastic surgery. He was with his love child. He'd been deposed. He was dead. Julia Yaffe.
He was.
Where was he?
Who knows? Nobody knows.
That's, I mean, we bring you in. You're like our Kremlinologist.
I told you I'm not a scientist.
You can be a Kremlinologist.
Well, here's the thing. It is a classic situation that one faces when reporting on something this sensitive in the Kremlin. The people who are talking do not know, and the people who know are not talking. So that's when the rumor mill steps in and we get the love child and the plastic surgery and the coup and the flu and that Putin ate his own love child. I mean, you can, it's a, like,
was there a love child?
He's got the coup flu. He must have love children the way we have ties.
On the love child front, if he has one now, I don't think it would be considered a love child, just because it seems like he married the gymnast, Alina Kabaeva. So he, in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics, he announced his divorce in that super awkward way, right? He's walking out with his wife from the ballet and happens to encounter some cameramen hiding in the bushes. And he's like, oh, hi, I'm getting divorced. And then he started appearing with a wedding ring on his finger. He appeared with a wedding ring at Sochi and many other times. And there were rumors, again, that he had wed the gymnast up at a monastery in Valdai, which is a region near St. Petersburg that he really likes. So,
but she doesn't appear as the first lady or whatever the Russian.
No, she used to be in the parliament. And then now she is the chairman of the board of one of the largest media companies around. She's very talented.
Yes, she is.
And it was a gymnast.
She's also double Lutzinger.
Wasn't she a rhythmic gymnastic?
Yeah, that's
not
right.
Like, that's like
I mean,
gymnast.
Some of the photos I that exist of her online are just straight up obscene. Like, yeah.
What do you mean?
Like, there's, you know, the way she bends, like, certain parts of her anatomy should not be on her head.
Oh, okay.
Huh.
Gotcha. Right. So he's
like,
married.
She's got a pancreas.
It seems that these are all unconfirmed rumors, and I'm not a scientist again. Mm-hmm. He seems to have had two love children with her earlier while he was still married to Lyudmila. And they're called Dmitry and a girl. I don't know. Anyway, that's all I'll say about the love children.
So, okay. But why do this? Does he do this just to mess with people? Or do you think there was probably a reason for it?
There was probably a reason. Maybe he was sick. Maybe there was a political crisis inside the Kremlin that we don't know about. What we can say about it is the fact that he came out and mocked everybody's worries about the absence and said life would be boring without rumors. And then his press secretary, who for all of those 10 or 11 days that he was missing, was saying everything's fine, came out and mocked the journalists who had been asking. He was like, did you see the man who died or was deposed in a flu? Did you guys all see him? So the fact that they were so mocking when Putin reappeared. I mean, it's legitimate. The man has a nuclear briefcase. He apparently put the nuclear whatever on guard when he was taking over Crimea a year ago. He disappeared. Nobody knew where he was, including Washington. You know, you should have some answers ready. And the fact that they came out with a big, you know, flipping everybody the bird does indicate how little esteem they hold public opinion, that they don't have to answer to anybody.
So what, Julia, what did we learn about a Putinless Russia? Are there other sources of power that exist? Did we learn anything significant from this episode?
Well, as commentators far smarter than I am wrote during his absence, including Fiona Hill and Masha Gessen, what this shows is that there's no plan. We've known Putin to be a short-term tactician rather than a long-term strategist. The Kremlin never makes long-term plans. So we've learned that there is no successor, and we've learned that there's no strategy to deal with. I mean, Putin is 62. The average life expectancy for Russian men is 65. He is really pushing it when it
comes
to
numbers. But
doesn't
he work out 3 hours a day? He's very fit, that
guy. I mean,
it's
something like 60%. This was the statistic until a couple years ago, is that 60% of Russian men don't live past 60. So he's, you know, something will happen to him one day. And I think we'd all like to know, including, you know, everybody who fears them pushing the nuclear button, who comes after Putin? This has been, you know, throughout Russian history, pre-Soviet, Soviet history, when there's no succession plan in place, there is chaos. That's not great for the rest of the world either. I mean, this is also Putin's fault. I mean, this was by design. For the 15 years that Putin has been in power, he has so thoroughly eviscerated the opposition, so thoroughly cleared the political playing field of anybody who could even, you know, smack of rivaling him, that when something like this happens, let's say he died tomorrow, there's no natural successor. There's no natural even competitor that you could turn to. And that's scary. And his, I'm sorry, I'm rambling. I'll just finish up with this one last thought. One of the main political operators in the Kremlin at a big conference in the fall said, Vladimir Putin is Russia and Russia is Vladimir Putin. So what the hell happens when there's no Vladimir Putin?
Also, there are things like this Iranian agreement that they're trying to work out. I mean, Russia is not nominally, they're involved in that. So like what happens to the real business of Russia's a member, the P5+1 that's trying to put together this agreement with
also
Iran.
Also known as the P6.
Also, yeah. I know that. It's a good point.
It's the permanent five plus Germany. Germany.
Right.
It's like, yeah. No, they're still keeping
remember
the
war. Don't you remember the war?
Yeah.
I've heard about it, yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, there's real business to be done. It's not just whether he's...
But they haven't been cooperating for the last couple of years. Ever since the annexation of Crimea and the invasion of eastern Ukraine, since Russia was kicked out of the G8, they're not really cooperating on many things. And that's also by design. Putin felt part of the revanchist streak started with Russia's...
I use revanchist.
Started with Russian cooperation on Libya.
Right.
And that cooperation was, I mean, that was so much cooperation. It was an abstention in the UN Security Council when the West voted to, you know, send in a mission to Libya. And it ended with Gaddafi being murdered on camera, which freaked Putin out. He apparently obsessed about the way Gaddafi died for a long time. So ever since then, he felt that the West did a bait and switch on him. And ever since then, he's not really been wanting to cooperate.
When the history is written of insane people who appear totally crazy and insane, you know, we find out like in the basement, they've got, you know, things that made them even more crazy and insane. On a scale of 1 to 100, where 100 is maximum glowing, can see it from space, crazy, where is Putin in your view right now?
I don't know what number I would assign him, but he's steadily climbing towards 100.
Right.
And I mean, this is the part of the tragedy of, you know, the hubris of autocracies is Putin came in, cheered on by the West, cheered on by Boris Nemtsov, who was assassinated outside the Kremlin walls 3 weeks ago, because the oligarchs, the West, were riding roughshod over Russia. And he was seen as the man who could take the country back, give, you know, a level of economic stability and comfort to the population, which he did. If he had really bowed out in 2008, he would have gone down as a great politician. People would have said, you know, there were a few excesses like the jailing of oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, et cetera. But he would have provided Russians with an amount of prosperity and freedom they had never, ever had in their history. And now he's going into, you know, Gaddafi territory. Soon he's going to be pitching tents, you know, in Paris.
Given that, first of all, is there any possibility of if he doesn't die, because he is very fit, but let's say he doesn't die, any possibility of alternative power, someone taking power, him somehow losing a grip on power or not? I mean, the history is not good on that. And Stalin never lost a grip on power.
Well, and then, right, but then when he died in 1953, it's funny, he died on March 5th. March 5th was the last public sighting of Vladimir Putin. After he died, there was a lot of reshuffling in the ranks. A lot of people got killed. You know, his number two, Beria, who was head of the secret police, was for a while the successor. Then he was purged. I mean, it was...
Right, but do you see that is there a possibility of Putin allowing there to be any kind of alternative power source? Because if you name a successor, that means that people have an incentive to...
Well, you hobble yourself.
Yeah.
You make yourself a lame duck.
Yeah.
It's not in Putin's style to name a successor. You can look at what he did in the run-up to 2008. So he likes following the letter of the law and using that to rape the spirit of the law. For example, the Russian Constitution says you can serve two consecutive terms as president. So he interpreted that to mean he can serve as many two consecutive terms as he wants, as long as he takes breaks right in between. And in the run-up to his second term running out in 2008, he floated, the Kremlin let a bunch of names leak, that they were all being considered as potential successors. And that's the way Putin likes to do it. He likes to play, you know, the card dealer at the blackjack table, and likes to have lots of people in suspension, lots of people in competition with each other. So I think we wouldn't find out till the very last minute who the successor is.
Given the unipolar nature of Russia now, what are we to do? Because it doesn't seem like it would help anybody in Russia if the West appears to help them. That doesn't seem like anyone would want to be the person who's receiving Western aid at this point or Western assistance.
You mean like, in the opposition?
In the opposition or anywhere. Or even that you want to be the business that's doing a lot of business with the West.
Right.
Presumably.
No.
No one is going to want to touch
that's right.
that. So what should we do? Should we isolate? Should we
well, we're in the process.
Sanction?
You mean isolate further?
Yeah. Can you do this part in a Russian accent?
Or just do it in Russian.
Who knows? It's tough to say. Russia's a hard one. You know, you implement sanctions, you think things are going to go one way, but Russia has a way of surprising everybody. I would personally sanction the hell out of even more Russians, you know, to isolate Putin further, to fracture the elite even further, to put pressure on him to change his politics. But so far, it's not the sanctions. I mean, the sanctions are stressing the elite out, it seems. But really, what's really hitting Putin is the low oil prices, and the Saudis are doing our work for us.
Right. But the sanctions, so if you're a Russian billionaire, can you still go to London and can you still build your
depends on which billionaire
house?
I mean, if I had my way, and I'm a horrible sadist, but if I had my way, I would
do it in a Russian accent.
If I were a horrible sadist, I would kick out the wives and children of these top Russian bureaucrats, top Russian functionaries, top Russian businessmen who are living wonderful lives in Europe and Russia, while their husbands and fathers are in Russia rattling sabers, invading other countries, talking about Russian patriotism. So, for example, Pavel Astakhov, a wonderful TV lawyer who became the Kremlin-appointed protector of all of Russia's children and who pushed through the law banning American adoptions of Russian orphans. Russia has more orphans now than it did at the end of World War II, by the way. Where do his kids live? In Nice. So if you're such a gosh darn patriot, have your kids live in Russia. See how they like it.
The Gabfest is also brought to you this week by Harry's.com, which makes great shaving products. I need to actually reorder my Harry's razors. I have a full beard. Yes, John, you're staring at me, but I use my Harry's razor on the neck part of my beard.
Yeah.
And this little area here, which kind of hates that area to have hair on it, like the area right.
The cheek.
The top of the cheek. For the audience, he's pointing to his knee. It's a little weird.
Makes blush application really hard, I find.
So Harry's.com has a starter set for just $15, which includes a razor, three blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming shave gel. I use the shave cream. Very good in the shower. And as an added bonus, you can get $5 off your first purchase with our code, which is political. So you can get an entire month's worth of shaving for just $10. Or if you're me, that's like 3 months worth of shaving because I don't have to use my razors that much. And shipping is always free with Harry's. So go to harrys.com right now, and Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in our code political with your first purchase. That's harrys.com. Enter coupon code political to check out for $5 off the starter set and to start shaving smarter today. So Aaron Schock this week announced his resignation. He resigns, I guess, effective at the end of the month. It's a wonderful cascading series of events that began with a fantastic Washington Post story about him having redecorated his office in a Downton Abbey-type decor. He'd been given the redecoration by an all-too-talkative designer. And
from a company called Eurotrash.
It was. The
interior design boutique bureau that did that.
It's called Eurotrash.
It's called Eurotrash.
And it must be awesome. Said that the normal.
Should be one of your sponsors.
The normal three-term congressman's office is not a thing to behold. It's just highly. It's just not that fancy at all. And so this was really at the other end. I mean, when you've been in Congress for 30 years, then your office gets a little nicer. But this really, this was extraordinary.
It was extraordinary.
It also didn't really look like the decor in Downton Abbey. I've watched a little Downton Abbey, and there's not that much, like blood red wall. It was a little goth.
Yeah, I think the Downton thing was maybe a little bit overplayed. Yeah. It was more just like, we're going to do garish, old-timey mm-hmm. decoration. Not
Pheasant feathers.
If you had a dungeon fetish room that was done in Downton Abbey, that's the look. Go for it.
Maybe they do. Maybe
with
that will
feathers.
Be in season 7 of Downton Abbey. But so that was the first stage. Then there was other stories about him using private jets a lot. He has a very active Instagram feed. It's clear he's vacationing a lot. He took some junkets, and he took a lot of staff on junkets in ways that seem incredibly suspicious. But to me, the thing that did him in was it turned out he had overbilled for mileage, that he had gotten a car. First of all, he got a $75,000 car basically free. But then he had billed Congress and his campaign for mileage that he didn't drive. And as anyone who has ever billed for mileage knows, it's hard to bill for mileage. But, I think we can all become I don't think billing 127,000 miles on a car that you only drove 80,000 miles seems a little bit unseemly. And I think that made people very, very angry and probably was the final straw. But, John, was that the final straw?
I think so. He was basically Politico, which did the legwork on this, called him up and said, hey, there's a massive gap here between what you drove and what you claimed. And then very soon thereafter, maybe even the same day, he resigned. I mean, there's an ethics investigation that was opened into him. And also he had he'd come under scrutiny after there was a report that the home that he'd sold in Peoria had been bought by a donor. And we should say there's something about Illinois politicians, because you remember Barack Obama had his own problem with a donor who gave him very favorable terms on his Resco. Mike Resco? Resco was the last name.
Resco. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it was A something. Was it Mike? I thought it was Andre Resco.
So there's something about good real estate and Illinois politicians. But, I mean, you got the sense that there was more, perhaps to be found. I mean, it was, as you said, cascading, and you didn't feel like the last drop of water had hit.
It's a kind of dumbass corruption. Tony Resco. Anthony. But Anthony Resco, right?
Anthony. Yes, Anthony, yeah. Tony Resco.
Yeah, that's why I had an A. So, but it's a kind of dumbass corruption that you don't see that much anymore. Most people are smart enough to make sure they're not doing the stupid stuff.
It is weird. You don't usually hang a lamp on it. Like, that's what the Downton Abbey thing and the Instagramming and the that he just didn't have any sense of how really out of control this was. And then there's the cover of Men's Health at the start. It was the most celebritization of The Office with no countervailing other things. So Paul Ryan does his P90X. He has a kind of quasi-celebrity status. Of course, he's been there longer, done a lot more. But he also does a lot of legislation, has a lot of ideas. I mean, as Chris Saliza wrote about him, he said, Schock's main contribution in Congress, aside from his social media presence, seemed to be eyeing jobs he didn't have and raising money so that one day he might have them.
Well, it seems like this is just one offshoot of that horrible weed of money in politics these days. I mean, it seems like he got away with a lot of this stuff because of how much money he was able to raise for the Republican Party, which makes sense. If he's just a money guy, then he's also making some money for himself. He's making some money for his party. That's his role. He's not there to make to pass legislation. I just love reading the coverage about it. There was so little the media had to say about him. It's like now they've all these corruption scandals actually gave them grist for their stories. Because before, I mean, there was a New York Times story that I loved. They said, Schock 33, a young media savvy Republican, had drawn attention for his physical fitness.
Right. You know, like, his advocacy.
No,
of,
fundraising prowess. Like, he was known for his physical fitness.
I think that's exactly right. Because at first, there's a whole bunch that's bundled to the money problem. One, he is kept around because he can raise lots and lots of money. Because he's raising money, he's hanging around with people who have expensive tastes, and he spends time in the company with and flying to and being and marinating.
So it's like a Bob McDonald situation.
And you are
it's a Bill Clinton problem,
right? You're constantly associated and with those kinds of people. And also, by the way, it helps that you be good looking in that context. And then I think there's not really, you know, when John Boehner said last year that the goal of Congress is measure Congress not by the laws it passes, but by the ones it keeps from being passed. There is
they've succeeded.
Yeah.
Everything. They did it.
Now, that was a slightly important caveat. That's when Republicans didn't control all of Congress. Now they do. And there's a different pressure on them. But I guess the point is Schock was not going to be reviled by his constituents for not passing lots of legislation and putting his name on lots of bills, because that's not valued in the way celebrity is now.
But given what you guys both describe, isn't it then surprising there isn't more of it? Because all politicians are associating now with super rich people and trying to get money out of super rich people. To get anywhere in life, you have to practice a form of delayed gratification most of the time. And so if you're a politician, I suppose, and you care about money, that form of delayed gratification is I'm going to serve. I'm going to get the glory of being in Congress now. And I know that when I leave, I can walk out to $1 million-a-year job doing whatever, lobbying.
The Eric Cantor model.
Yeah, that you just know it and that you delay the gratification because you know that's going to happen. And
but
because he's a millennial, because he's part of your generation, Julia, he wasn't able to exercise that self-discipline. What is it about your generation that causes you people to be like that?
That's right. Not enough self-flagellation. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that because serving is now so tied to money. You're constantly expected to fundraise. You're constantly trying to make money for your next election or for your party or for your, you know, fellow party members. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that with the coming election, especially as the Clintons, you know, are once again opened up to scrutiny and the, you know, Clinton Foundation comes into focus again. And I mean, that was built what John described was part of Bill Clinton's problem, right? Is that he's a politician, but he's hanging out with people with expensive tastes and private jets. And
as a post-president.
As a post president, but now his wife's name is on the foundation and it's getting money from sovereign governments. And she was while she was Secretary of State, you know, there's a lot of I think we're going to see a lot more stuff coming out.
So, David, which of the following things or is more probable or assign a percentage of probability to each one? A, he's reelected. B, he gets a talk show. C, he's on Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, C is good. C is good. Yeah. That's good.
Because he will have, there's not going to be, like he's already passed the shame thing.
Can you do B and C?
Yeah. He gets a talk show.
He could still be a fundraiser, right? Could he still raise money for the Republican Party? Like in the shadows?
Yeah, after maybe a...
Like throw some parties?
I'm not sure.
After a sufficient interregnum. Which would be, you know, a couple months.
I wouldn't have said in my brief encounter with him that he seemed curious enough to be a good talk show host. he was very interested in himself in our conversation. But he was
unlike Rush Limbaugh, you know.
Well, no, Rush Limbaugh is very interested in the world. Rush Limbaugh, you can say a lot of things about Rush Limbaugh, but he's very curious. He has a lot of strong opinions. And Rush Limbaugh isn't an interviewer. He just is a monologuist. One last question on this. So one thing that occurs when something like this happens is when he goes down, or Wiener goes down, or what, Mark Foley, or, you know, when a congressman goes down, the average congressman doesn't matter. Is there any congressman who could be taken out that you would think this is going to have an actual effect on politics?
You mean the Wilbur Mills kind of,
yes,
somebody really
is
super.
Is there anyone whose sudden departure would make a difference? It's hard to see that would matter anywhere.
I think the speaker would. People say, you know, John Boehner doesn't have control of the place, but he has more control over the House than anybody else would be able to have. They need their appropriations chairman this year, if they're going to really pass appropriations bills. But your point is essentially right. I mean, you wouldn't, you know. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, it's become so the institutions are so abstracted from individual relationships and what the role of individuals in them.
Well, this is again part of the problem. We've talked about this with respect to the Senate, but it's true in the House as well, is that there used to be a pathway where you could not be, you know, there's the old dialectic between the show horse and the workhorse. There was a workhorse track where you could work inside and be, you know, get power little by little by little, and then become a committee chairman, and then you'd be really powerful. You'd be one of the 13 cardinals, the head of the appropriations committees, or, you know, you'd be head of ways and means. Now those things ain't what they used to be, except as a way to get you booked on talk shows. I mean, they're not, you know, I mean, they're powerful, but they're nothing like the way they used to be powerful. They used to be more powerful than the leadership in certain circumstances.
When you, John, are sitting in your Downton Abbey themed office. I've seen your office. It's very the flocked wallpaper, the meerschaum pipe.
The little stool for my gentleman's gentleman.
Yeah. I don't even know what that means. What is your gentleman's gentleman?
It's a valet.
Oh. Oh, okay.
He's, you know, the little stool that's in the corner that he sits on while he's preparing.
If I had to pick one Slate employee to have a valet, it would be you. You would have a valet. You'd make good use of a valet. You'd have a good, strong relationship with your valet. You don't have to answer that.
Yeah, no. I mean, would you be
chattering
to anything?
You do drink cocktails. What would you be chattering about to your valet?
Boy, do I ever! What I want to talk about is a story that was printed in ProPublica. This is a great segue from the Aaron Schock thing. Thank you for setting that up. It's about antebellum data journalism, and so the piece starts off by talking about the fact that data journalism that we all know and love today has been around for a lot longer than people think. We all think it's a modern result of computers and things, but the very first issue of the Manchester Guardian on the 5th of May in 1821 contained four pages of that were just a huge table showing the real number of students in church schools, and that number of students exceeded the estimates of the student population made by proponents of education reform. So this was the first effort to use big data. Well, the great use of big data in this that's outlined in this piece was by the editor of the New York Tribune, Horace Greeley, who was himself a huge figure, sort of even bigger than, say, Mike Bloomberg, but had that dual role. And the Tribune was the largest circulation newspaper in the United States. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Greeley does the thinking for the whole West at $2 per year for his paper." So what did Horace Greeley do? Well, he didn't like the fact that when members of Congress went back to their home districts, that they were getting paid 40 cents a mile for the trips. 40 cents a mile.
That's a ton.
Yeah. In the mid 1800s, they were getting 40 cents a mile, and he thought this was ridiculous.
What is that in today's dollars?
Well, I'll get to that. I don't know what that is today's dollars, but I know what an aggregate figure for one of the scoff laws was. So there are two routes he had. One is he could just, you know, gas on about how he didn't like this in an editorial. The other was that he could do the math. Aha. And he went and did the math. So what he did was he looked at the routes that they claimed they were traveling when they went for compensation. And then he had a fellow named Douglas Howard, who was a former postal clerk, and he used the post office book of mail routes to calculate the shortest path from those two, because it was in the interest of the U.S. Post Office to move lickety-split between these places, but not in the interest of the billing congressman. But, of course, to get the routes and the amounts that the congressman charged required going and getting the information from Congress. And so in the piece that Greeley writes, he says the Secretary of the Senate refused to permit a transcript of the mileage of that illustrious body to be taken, even on the requisition of a member of the House. In other words, even if it was officially asked for by a member of the House. So they then had to go over to the Treasury Department, where he wrote, "Our reporter was tossed about from bureau to bureau of the Treasury buildings for some time before he could obtain sight of the documents in question." So nothing has changed in terms of being stonewalled by the officials. But they went and did the calculation. A huge table runs in the paper. And it turns out one of the great abusers of this was none other than Abraham Lincoln. So Abraham Lincoln from Springfield, Illinois, made a receipt of some $677 in excess mileage. So that's the mileage he claimed minus how much he had a right to claim using the postal route. And that would equate to $18,700 of overcharging in today's dollars. And that made Lincoln among the House's worst abusers of this.
Is that on one trip or that's on?
No, no, that's in the course of, I guess, one session of Congress. He was only in one Congress.
How was his men's health cover?
Yes.
In same district. He was the same district as Aaron Shaw.
His abs were flabby abs. Yeah.
Of wood.
Yeah.
Did they, wait, I had a question about this. So that's overage. That's more than.
That's more.
More
that's
than
the
what
bad.
He was entitled
yeah, yeah,
to.
Yeah, more than $677 more than he was entitled
what
to.
What was his salary at that point? Do we know?
I don't know what his salary was. I don't know. And John, by the way, John C. Calhoun and Jefferson Davis were also went over.
Did they track every member of Congress?
I don't think he tracked every. He just tracked. There looks like there are about 30 here or 20 here that were the particular abusers of this.
And was there any punishment for them or just shame?
No.
Public shaming.
I think it was public shaming. And then I think the fee was, I think, changed, but I'm not actually positive about that. But Greeley writes, "It is for the sake of urging this question," which is to say to reform the law that compensated the mileage with those rates. "It is for the sake of urging this question that we have chosen to take the risk of giving offense to some friend in Congress who may fancy himself exhibited at disadvantage by this publication." They were very nervous about
it. I remember whenever the last time I billed for mileage, which was probably 10 years ago, it was only 50 cents a mile. I mean, it's that it could be 40 cents a mile in the 1850s is amazing. I guess transportation was relatively expensive compared to what it is today because you had all these horses. And so that was probably much harder to be transported, but still.
And also you can imagine members of Congress didn't like this, that he was calling them out on this. And right. So he was denounced by various members of Congress.
Julia, what is your chatter?
So this past week, Russia celebrated the 1-year anniversary of the annexation of Crimea. And
woo! Go team.
I know, right? They won everything. So what was interesting about this is the Kremlin-owned television kicked off with a documentary that they showed that had been produced by Russia 24, which is one of the state-owned channels. A long documentary, I think 2.5 hours, with a long interview by Vladimir Putin. And this aired before Putin reappeared. And in this documentary, Putin outlines how he personally controlled the invasion of Crimea, how he, put the country on nuclear alert, and he was ready and willing to use nuclear weapons to defend his maneuvers there, and was just pretty frank and upfront about things that he was swearing up and down a year ago were not the case. You know, if you recall, a year ago when Russian soldiers started appearing in Crimea without their insignia on their uniforms, Putin and people around him, official representatives of the Russian Federation, insisted that these were, in fact, local volunteers who just wanted to defend the Russian language and Russian culture and wanted badly to have a referendum on joining Russia and independence from Ukraine. And the day after this documentary aired, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said, if Europe and America want to reach a final deal on eastern Ukraine, they really just have to talk to the parties to the conflict. And Russia has nothing to do with it, so it can't really be party to the talks. And this was 1 year after. I mean, it's the same kind of denial. 1 year after the Crimea annexation, one day after Putin said, "Oh yeah, I was totally lying," and then you had the celebrations, the massive celebrations all over Russia. celebrating the Crimean annexation, which, of course, this being Russia, ended up being kind of ridiculous. You had Vladimir Putin, a day after his reappearance, singing the national anthem from stage. As you know, he likes to sing in public.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, remember he sang at a fundraiser for a children's cancer charity.
Nice voice?
Yeah, he's all right. He sang Blueberry Hill. He sat down on the piano, tickled the ivories, and sang Blueberry Hill.
Have you seen the House of Cards, this season's House of Cards?
So this was my other part of of my cocktail party chatter. Is Thursday, Vladimir Putin's press secretary said, actually, Vladimir Putin has not seen the House of Cards, and he has not even been told that his image is being used in House of Cards.
House of Cards has a scene with a Russian, this season has a scene with a Russian president visiting the White House, state dinner, and the president then sings and dances somewhat immodestly with the first lady.
It's because of the Blueberry Hill performance. Yeah. And that, by the way, was for a charity, a children's cancer charity. And it turned out that all the money raised from that event, like Mickey Rourke was there, Sharon Stone was there, all these Western celebrities were there. Turns out no money ever made it to any kids with cancer.
Where'd it go? Who knows?
Who knows? I need house, you know. And one more thing about the Crimea celebrations, they were phenomenal. A local politician in St. Petersburg announced that he would like to celebrate the annexation, the Crimea joining the Ukraine. I mean, Russia. He like publicly fumbled it, and in a city in Crimea, they decked out the local government decked out the streets in what was meant to be the Russian flag, but they got the stripes in the wrong the color stripes in the wrong order. And then people were spotted. There was a huge demonstration and concert right off of the Red Square the other day. And people were like at every ATM right off of the Red Square, people were lining up and just withdrawing money because a lot of times people are paid to go to these demonstrations. Yeah. Oh, and there were also images. My favorite was an image of the old ladies who came out to this rally concert being fed blyny, Russian pancakes, like from a shovel. There's like this giant mass of dough extended to them on a shovel, and they're picking off chunks of dough from the shovel. It was just, you know, really bread and circus.
My chatter is about a great new book from Eric Larson, the author of Devil in the White City and In the Garden of the Beast. He has a book called Dead Wake, which is about the sinking of the Lusitania, which is the passenger liner that was taken down by a German U-boat in 1915 and is one of the instigating acts of the U.S.'s entry into World War I somewhat later. It's a great book. And, you know, if you haven't read a Larson book, you should read Devil in the White City. And this one is also great. But the best parts are about how horrible submarines are, which as someone who hates claustrophobia and hates water, submarines are my worst nightmare. But basically, it turns out in the early days of submarines, if you got in a submarine, you died. So in the Civil War, the first submarine attack, the Huntley attacks a U.S. ship, Confederate ship attacks a Union ship, and they successfully sink this Union ship, but everyone in the submarine also dies. All the testing for the early German submarines, they would have these subs, and they'd send out a crew with 8 people on the crew. They would all die. They'd salvage the boat. They'd send out another crew on this boat to try to fix it. They'd all die. They'd do it again.
Of the depressurizing?
It would just sink. They'd end up sinking. Oh. They'd all like, and it's terrible. It is a terrible way to die because you die, you know,
slowly.
You can die fast, which is probably better if like the whole thing falls apart. But if you don't, you're in this. You die of lack of oxygen. The environment is it's very humid and fetid. And so it's even in the best circumstances, it's just you feel terrible. And the German subs were, at the time, at least they were low oxygen environments because they need to preserve the amount of oxygen they had. So they wouldn't put as much oxygen in the air as you really need. So you were constantly slightly oxygen deprived. So people would sleep all the time. And everything in a World War I sub, the diesel fuel would get everywhere. So everything tasted like diesel fuel. And then when you would die, there were these subs that would be recovered, and they would find the marks of the men trying to claw their way out of, you know, they're in a side of steel hull. They're 400 meters under the water. What are they going to do? But they're like, they can't go anywhere, but they have to get out. It's awful. It is awful. It's
you told me not totally to do a depressing cocktail chatter.
Ruined my summer plans to go do the World War I German submarine reenactment.
You could not pay me enough to get in a submarine. I wouldn't. That is, I would never get in a submarine.
Is there anybody who would pay you to get in a submarine?
The U.S. Navy would, presumably.
Even now?
And yet you would fly in a plane.
What do you mean?
But wait.
Pay me to get in a submarine. Probably like a drug. Probably like this drug sub.
But wait, do a Kickstarter.
You fly in planes?
Yeah. Early aviators also died in great numbers.
No, I know, but you.
Yes.
Is it the water or the lack of windows?
The water. If you die in a plane, like it's fast, right? You're dead. You just go down, done.
Yeah.
There's no waiting around.
Maybe they tell you. Well, what if they tell you? I mean, like we're experiencing turbulence, or there's a problem, and then there's quite a while until you actually die.
No, that would be terrifying and miserable. It would be it would be your last hour of your life, and it would be a horror show.
I did not mean to take us down this road.
That would be an hour, right? And then it would be dead.
Goodbye. Oh, no, I'm just saying goodbye to the last listener who just left. He's about to leave. See ya. Have a good run or end of a run.
Our intern is Dark Barrett. Our producer is Mike Volo. He's still here. They're both still here, thank goodness. Our managing producer
is Joel Meyer. This room feels
like their way out of the Slate office.
It is. The humidity levels are about where they would be.
Are there claw marks on the walls of the Slate office?
Yes. Yes. I'm surprised you're not we've locked the door from the inside here, Julia. You can't actually. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest. It has links to what we talked about today. Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @slategabfest. And our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the GabFest in iTunes. For Julia Yaffe and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week. Emily will be back. Julia, you were great. Come back anytime. Seriously.
Thank you.
But
that
not
was fun.
Not to the exclusion of Emily. We can have you both.
Hi, this is James Ledbetter, editor of Inc. magazine and Inc.com. I hope you'll listen to Inc. Uncensored, our podcast about business, startups, entrepreneurship, technology, and cool companies. This week, we talked about, John,
a venture-backed bus service in San Francisco and spicy fried chicken.
Maria Aspen,
the ice cream otherwise known as Cheeky Monkey, a ripoff or homage to Ben & Jerry's.
And Will Yakowitz,
drones that may or may not kill you, and an international bromance sparked by a stolen iPhone.
That's Inc. Uncensored in a nutshell.
I'd listen to it.
Check out the show at itunes.com/panoply.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.